Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, sometimes the easiest way to do the news is to let people speak for themselves.
Inflation currently is too high.
So no pressure here, Mr. Chairman, but what you gonna do about it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 16th of July, which by my count makes it four out of the last five business days that the chairman of the Federal Reserve has led the news. Although for a change, it had nothing to do with the woes of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. More about those in a minute, by the way. No, Mr. Bernanke spent a lot of time today talking to Congress about prices. This morning, the Labor Department told us inflation at the consumer level shot up more than 1% last month. The worst-kept secret in economics is that skyrocketing energy prices deserve much of the blame for that. But no matter the reason why, today's report puts the Federal Reserve in a tough spot, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Economists expected to see signs of inflation in today's report, but not like this. Food prices were up almost 1% in June. Gas prices rose 10%.
Certainly, they're a surprise. They're stronger than expected.
That's Hugh Johnson, chief economist at Johnson Illington Advisors.
If ever there was a time when I would not want to be chairman of the Federal Reserve, it's right now. They obviously are faced with a very severe problem.
On the one hand, the economy remains sluggish. That, combined with the credit crisis, would normally motivate the Federal Reserve to lower rates, making it easier to borrow. But with prices going up, the Fed must also consider raising rates to curb inflation. Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, says the Fed is torn.
The way they've sort of settled this is that they're probably not going to do anything for a year or so. They'll just sit frustrated on the sideline, putting out brush fires like Bear Stearns and Fannie Mae.
Others suggest the Fed may raise rates sooner. Hugh Johnson says the problem is not just inflation, but the fear that it will get worse.
We're worried about higher inflation, and that sometimes creates a self-fulfilling component where we might see higher prices just simply because we're so worried about it.
As if there weren't enough to worry about already, today the Labor Department also reported a big dip in wages and salaries. Adjusted for inflation, income fell almost 1% last month, the steepest decline in 24 years. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The stock stories of the day trade under the symbols FRE and FNM. Both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac shot higher today, about 30% apiece. It seems it took the markets a couple of days, but everybody's accepted the notion that the government-backed mortgage companies aren't going to fail, now that they're even more government-backed. The Treasury Department and the Fed are standing by with cash, and the Securities and Exchange Commission has decided to tighten up some rules on short selling. That is, betting a stock is going to go down. I told you at the end of the broadcast yesterday, the SEC is cracking down on an especially risky variety of short selling, naked shorting it's called, which has in turn prompted a big debate on Wall Street about how much shorting, naked or otherwise, ought to be allowed. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
There's nothing illegal about short selling. The worry is too much could force a stock to lose value faster than it would otherwise. Ted Weisberg's been trading on Wall Street for decades. He says the SEC should bring back the short sale rule, also known as the plus tick rule. It says selling short is fine, but you can't do it at the absolute rock bottom price.
That rule basically prevented the short sellers from just pounding the stock down by just hitting every bid in sight.
The rule was only rescinded a year ago, and it doesn't look like the SEC is going to go back on that decision. For now, it's only restricting one kind of short selling, and on a small number of companies for a limited time. Bill Fleckenstein is a hedge fund manager. He thinks even that's too much.
Is the SEC going to be able to come up with some rules that's going to make the price of these financial institutions go up? No. Is the Treasury going to be able to? No. Is the Fed going to be able to? No.
He says that means no amount of regulation will turn the market around, and the government should stop picking on the short sellers.
The short selling is not the problem that caused these stock prices to be where they are, so that's not going to change anything.
Fleckenstein says only more serious issues can push stock prices down and keep them there. Things like poor management. But trader Weisberg isn't buying it.
Wall Street is driven by so much of psychology that if the psychology is negative enough and you scare people enough, you can cause a lot of downward momentum.
Executives at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers would argue that kind of momentum is something no amount of good management can make up for. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Here's some psychology for you of the political variety. Democrats in Congress have an unusual ally in their test of economic wills with the White House. Republicans. This week, GOP lawmakers have helped override a presidential veto on Medicare, and they've called for more time to consider the Treasury Department's plan to help Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer looked into what's behind Republican rebelliousness.
Republicans are openly questioning the Bush plan for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It would give the government temporary authority to loan Fannie and Freddie money and even buy their shares. Some Republicans say they don't want to expose taxpayers to too much risk. And Republicans don't feel beholden to a lame duck president. Jordan Lieberman publishes Politics Magazine.
Congressional Republicans feel they have the license to oppose the president because it's not going to affect them negatively politically.
Former Clinton Treasury Secretary Larry Summers says that frees up congressional Republicans to vote their fiscal conscience.
There's a very legitimate desire on the part of many in Congress to make sure there is no subsidy from taxpayers to the management or owners of the government-sponsored enterprises.
Government-sponsored enterprises is economist speak for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Of course, it doesn't hurt that members of Congress up for re-election are worried about what voters would say if they thought they were being stuck with a bailout. Stephen Hess of the Brookings Institution says congressional Republicans have been getting an earful from constituents about an unpopular president.
They are getting a lot of unhappy comments, thoughts, letters, and phone calls from the folks back home. It would pinch the Democrats in the same way with the situation somewhat reversed.
Those comments have emboldened Republicans to stand up to the president in the name of protecting taxpayers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Wells Fargo boosted its dividend this morning, and all of a sudden, investors loved bank stocks. Financials drove things higher on Wall Street. Today, we will have the details when we do the numbers. Probably should have mentioned this as a factor in the rally on Wall Street today. Oil fell to $134 a barrel, down another $4 at the close. Of course, the price of crude is a fickle beast, and today is a great example. There was an unexpected rise in U.S. oil inventories, usually something that makes prices go down, as they did today. But there was also another militant attack in Nigeria's oil-rich Niger Delta, something that usually makes prices rise. Seeing as how Nigeria produces about 2 million barrels of crude a day, it seems like the next logical step on our tour of why oil prices move the way they do. Fareed Mohammadi is with the consulting group PFC Energy in Washington. Mr. Mohammadi, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Place Nigeria for me in the context of the world oil market, would you?
Well, it is a very important producer for a number of reasons. One, it is a large producer of light sweet crudes. And the problems we're having in the world in terms of shortages is really related to light sweet crudes. Those are crudes that you can get high-yielding products like gasoline quickly. Secondly, it's in the Atlantic Basin. It's a short ride to the United States. And the U.S. has sought out Nigeria as one of the places it wants crude from because it helps diversify our supplies, possibly away from the Middle East.
Seems to me it's also important, though, for the headlines that pop up with increasing frequency saying militants attack in the oil-rich South, Shell pipeline shutdown or whatever company it is. It is extremely unreliable, no?
Yes, it has become a major contributor to price volatility because at any given time, something like 600,000 barrels plus can go offline. And in fact, there are whole regions in the Niger Delta that are ungovernable and that are out of the control of the government and have been taken over, as you say, by militants. And actually, the reason that you have these stoppages is because these different groups, especially in the Niger Delta, feel that they are not getting their just share and saying, no, we want it now. And especially now, because they're so desperate, firstly with their own conditions, but they're frightened that this time the oil boom will leave them behind. And then once they get a hold of the barrels, they smuggle them, they sell them, they become self-financing.
Let me get back to your point then about the United States hoping to get more oil from Nigeria. What does that say about American policy going forward? What can we do to ensure that supply?
Well, the U.S. hoped that as more and more supplies came off deep offshore, as they call it, from these platforms off the coast, that they would be away from politically volatile areas. But unfortunately, even those areas have come under attack. Recently, there was an attack 7 miles off the coast by rebel groups.
Is there going to come a day when foreign oil companies, the big foreign oil companies, say, you know what, Nigeria is too hard, it's not worth it, the government's not protecting us, we can't afford to protect our assets there, and they just pull out entirely?
Well, yes, there has been talk of that. Their own personnel who have been kidnapped and shot at and attacked on the one hand, on the other hand, the reputation risk. Remember, Shell had a problem a while back associating with an area that had severe human rights problems. So these companies are really reevaluating. It's still a fluid situation. I think that the fact that it's difficult to find new sources of oil will keep the major oil companies there.
What about rising demand from countries like China and India? I mean, it's not like the United States is the only oil customer out there.
No. In fact, West African crudes are highly coveted in Asia because they're light sweet and the refining systems are not as sophisticated in Asia. They also want to diversify away from the Middle East. So they also look at Nigeria as a place to diversify.
Mr. Mohammadi, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Fareed Mohammadi covers markets and country strategies for PFC Energy. That's a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. You can hear our discussion of other reasons why oil does what it does on our website. It's marketplace.org. Campaign finance reports filed late last night show that John McCain raised more than $62 million in the second quarter. Of course, he didn't do it alone. There are lots of politicians out there asking for contributions to the McCain campaign, and lots of politicians making contributions to the McCain campaign as well. But they're not doing it with their own money. They use what are called leadership political action committees, organizations that any lawmaker can set up for the express purpose of raising and spending money. In the first part of a special series on lawmakers and their political cash flow, Marketplace's Steve Henn explains how those PACs work in the presidential election.
When Barack Obama turned down federal funds for the general election, he boasted to his legion of small donors that his campaign had found a better way.
Instead of forcing us to rely on millions from Washington lobbyists and special interest PACs, you fueled this campaign with donations of $5, $10, $20, whatever you can afford.
It's true, Obama's campaign hasn't taken money from lobbyists or political action committees run by corporations and unions, but his own leadership PAC has. Leadership PACs are a carbon copy of corporate and union PACs. Their primary purpose is to raise money and share it with other party members facing tough election fights. Obama's PAC is called the Hope Fund, and it accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars from Washington lobbyists and special interests. Obama's not the only one with a leadership PAC. John McCain and nearly all the other candidates who competed in the primaries run these PACs too. And the reality is that politicians use this money for all sorts of things, not just to contribute to others' campaigns. Fred Wertheimer is founder of the campaign finance reform group Democracy 21. He says the lion's share of the donors to these accounts are actively lobbying on Capitol Hill.
It's Washington influence money almost entirely.
And he says it's a way for donors to give much larger amounts than they could otherwise.
Because they are really vehicles for outside donors to give contributions to a member that substantially exceed what they can give for their campaigns.
Federal Election Commission filings show that in 2006, a year before the official start of this presidential campaign, all the major candidates used leadership PACs to lay the groundwork for their bids. John McCain used his leadership PAC to pay for $1.3 million in private plane flights all across the country before the official start of the presidential race. Meredith McGeehy at the Campaign Legal Center says many of the trips happened to take him to important primary states.
Like Iowa and New Hampshire, just to take a couple, for example. And then you can go and use that leadership PAC to house some of your staff while they're waiting for the real campaign to start.
Campaign funds have strict limits on donations and what you can do with the money. So McGeehy says leadership PACs have become an indispensable tool.
You can use that money to pay for things that you don't want to use your hard-earned hard money for.
FEC reports show that key campaign advisors for McCain, Clinton, and Obama all drew salaries from their candidates' PACs before the presidential race officially began. Other candidates used their PACs to buy voter lists in Iowa and New Hampshire, or even pay for broadcast ads. Meredith McGeehy says one of the few rules governing leadership PACs bars candidates from using them to pay for their own campaigns, for president or Congress.
The reality is, in this presidential race, that whole system has fallen apart.
And in recent years, the campaign's main regulator, the Federal Election Commission, hasn't weighed in on whether anyone's crossed the legal line. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Stay tuned for more on leadership PACs from Steve next week. It's our special series. We're calling it PAC-Men. Coming up, sleepless nights for the CEO of Showtime.
I always have this feeling that when I open the door in my apartment in New York City and I pick up the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Variety, you know, what will have happened while I was asleep or trying to sleep that changes the business?
But first, let's do the numbers. Rally, peeps. That's the word you're looking for here. The Dow Industrials jumped 2.5% today, 276 points to close at 11,239. The Nasdaq gained 3.1%, 69 points to close at 2,284. The S&P 500 added 2.5%, 30 points, ended things at 1,245. Banks, as I mentioned, broke their losing streak after Wells Fargo reported higher than expected quarterly profits. Its shares deposited almost 33% today. J.P. Morgan rang up nearly 16%. Bank of America added on 22%. Lower oil prices helped UPS deliver a 4.75% gain, but shares in ExxonMobil siphoned off more than 2.75% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for June. President Bush is scheduled to travel to California to get an update on damage caused by wildfires. And the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee discusses ways to make our highways safer for travelers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. That monthly inflation report we started with today, up 1.1%, has gotten most of the attention. The really scary number, though, is the year-over-year comparison. Prices in June 2008 were 5% higher than June a year ago. That's the biggest jump in 17 years. Granted, we're still a long way from the hyperinflation of the 1970s, but commentator Robert Reich says what happened after that period should give us pause now.
What economists have called the Great Moderation, a period when the business cycle evened out and neither inflation nor recession posed much of a threat, began in the mid-1980s and now appears to be over. It was good when it lasted, but it led the nation to think we didn't need much by way of social insurance. Now, no one knows for sure what caused the Great Moderation. Some had credited the increased sophistication of financial markets and the wisdom of the Federal Reserve Board. Hindsight suggests it was more luck than anything else. Well, folks, it turns out the Great Moderation was something of a fluke. And now tens of millions of Americans are in trouble with no safety net to help them. That's because the apparent end of the boom and bust cycles led us to assume the economy would no longer impose such huge, unexpected, and arbitrary losses on large numbers of Americans. So we basically got rid of the safety nets. We abolished welfare, let unemployment insurance wither, and paid scant attention when corporations eliminated defined benefit pensions and cut health insurance benefits. We even stopped worrying about the safety of small investors. But now we have to rethink safety nets. Right now, nets are being spread for the wrong people. The giants of Wall Street, along with Fannie and Freddie, get bailed out, but there's still no relief in sight for most homeowners who can't pay their mortgages. Corporations that don't deliver on their pension obligations are helped out, but there's nothing for retirees and small investors whose savings are drying up because of Wall Street's decline. Yet I have to believe the end of the Great Moderation will eventually result in a broader safety net. Maybe not the old forms of social insurance, but new ones like universal health insurance, earnings insurance, and savings accounts in which the dollars you put away are supplemented by government dollars. The very rich and the biggest corporations don't need social insurance. Now that the booms and busts are back, the rest of us do.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. You can send us your thoughts. Go to our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. Primetime Emmy nominations are set to be announced tomorrow morning. HBO dominated last year with more than 20 wins, led, of course, by The Sopranos. But that show has since been whacked, which has left another vacuum other networks are hoping to exploit. None of them more than the number two premium cable channel, Showtime.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Showtime CEO Matt Blank. We sat down not too long ago on a soundstage out in West Los Angeles, and we talked about Showtime's chances in the new television landscape and life as part of the broadcast giant CBS.
Okay, as soon as Tent's here, I'll ask him if he is ready to shoot because I'm doing a last look.
Define success for him.
Oh boy, that's hard. I think everybody's got a different view of it. I mean, it's a lot easier to define today for Showtime than it was if we were doing this a couple of years ago.
Sort of helps that a certain show about a certain mafia family went out of business, right?
Yeah, that didn't hurt.
When you sit down for an interview, do you say to yourself quietly, if he asks me about HBO, I'm going to scream?
You know, I used to, because I used to have to always defend our situation versus HBO. Now it's just easier to say, you know, I can't control what HBO does. We're doing great. And that's true. You know, we spend very little time talking about those guys. I think we talked about them more when we weren't doing so well. But when you're doing well, you focus on yourself.
Do you think they talk about you now?
Oh, I bet they do, but I don't want to say that because then I'd be talking about HBO.
What keeps you up at night?
I always have this feeling that when I open the door in my apartment in New York City and I pick up the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Variety, you know, what will have happened while I was asleep or trying to sleep that changes the business? The media business changes incredibly quickly. The technology changes incredibly quickly. And our distribution environment changes incredibly quickly.
Showtime has gotten a lot of credit, actually, for using technology, using things like iTunes and making episodes available on the web. Obviously a conscious decision on your part. Why?
Well, you know, something we like to think that, you know, we're a little bit more aggressive in getting out there than maybe some of our competitors are, largely because we've been historically disadvantaged, historically number two, haven't always had the same marketing dollars to compete. So if somebody goes to iTunes or goes elsewhere and watches a season of Californication or a season of Dexter, hopefully what happens ultimately, they say, wow, I better subscribe to Showtime. That's a very important part of our marketing initiative.
And we'll go ahead and bring in our ladies. Here they are.
When Les Moonves, who runs CBS, calls you, and once you get past the, hi, Matt, how are you, what do you guys talk about? What does he want to know about how you're doing business?
Well, you know, Leslie has been really a terrific boss. I'm not going to go into all of them, but I've been CEO for 13 years. I've had seven bosses. So that's about as tumultuous a corporate history you can have. Leslie's been a tremendous supporter, but he's a very aggressive, competitive, hands-on CEO. You know, I will talk to Leslie. I've talked to him twice today already. You know, the nice thing is when I first went to work for him, he really didn't know much about our business. It was not the world he had come from. You know, when you put CSI on the air and it's a big success, you start monetizing it the next week. You know, it can take years for these shows to have the same value on Showtime.
So TV isn't TV isn't TV? I mean, one TV show is another TV show?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think that's true, even if you're just thinking of the creative product, but certainly as a business model, not at all. And, you know, I think there were times when people didn't think we had the best business model. I think now most people in television would be very jealous of the business model we have.
Describe it for me.
Well, you know, it's unique. First of all, I've always said that unlike most traditional networks, we're not purely in the eyeballs business. We have the luxury of being a little bit more in the hearts and minds business. And if we can own people's hearts and minds with shows like Weeds and Dexter, ultimately that accrues benefit to the brand. But if you create a new hit show, when CBS put CSI on the air and it did great, you know, within a week they're monetizing that success in terms of the size of the audience and the rates they can charge advertisers. You know, we don't need to premiere a show at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night and look at the ratings the next day and have had a huge winner. With us, this is a slow build. I don't think we've yet really seen the benefit of all this programming. I think we've got some great times ahead.
Matt Blank is the chairman and CEO of the Showtime Networks. Matt, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. This was great.
All right, here we go. Picture is up. Thank you. Very quiet.
We've got conversations from other corner offices archived on our website. The link is on our homepage, which is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, one that begins with a pair of nine-figure losses by Delta and American Airlines, both said this morning that almost all of the $1 billion in red ink can be blamed on the high cost of jet fuel. Southwest Airlines, by contrast, has managed to avoid those kinds of problems by hedging its fuel costs. But it does have other things to worry about. Southwest Flight 2709 from Houston to San Diego has the dubious distinction of being the most delayed commercial airline flight in the country. The Bureau of Transportation Statistics says that in May, 2709 was late 100% of the time. Think about it. You never got there on time. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. We got to get out on time. Today, the Dow bounced up 276 points, about 2.5%. The NASDAQ gained 69 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 ticked up 30 points, 2.5% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time.
We can go one eye or two.
One, three.
Can,
I want three eyes.
Let's see.
Can you do three eyes?
I'm
come
pretty
on.
Sure you can. Let's
see. If I'm going to play God, I want three eyes. Grand Theft Auto, it's not the next big video game tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.